Hello and welcome to Juno Afternoon. It's Wednesday, October 5th, 2022. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and on today's show, we'll talk with artist Glo Ramirez about her exhibit at the Alaska Robotics Gallery. The Foundation for End-of-Life Care will discuss their presentation to help children and teens deal with grief. Trout Unlimited will be here to tell us about their fly fishing film tour. We'll get the list of First Friday features from the Jack and hear episode one of Savory Moment, How to Make Your Salad Bowl Happy. Those conversations, sounds wild, music, and more coming up right here on Juno Afternoon. Weather, Sihudak Wusitan, it's raining. 60% chance of precipitation tonight with a low around 51 degrees. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akkwan. The Xinedi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. The tidelands where our studios sit are now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots, but they were once an embarking point for fishing and hunting grounds and gatherings in other villages, and a place where children played on the beaches and learned to row in the harbor. In sharing this history, KTOO hopes to honor the ancestors and the descendants of the Akkwan. We recognize those families who have never relinquished their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterways and continue to cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront for today and for future generations. We'd also like to take a moment and say thank you to the individuals who helped us craft our daily land acknowledgement. Gunashchish to Vera Starboard, who planted the idea of making it super place-specific and guided us on pronunciation. Lillian Petershore, who created so much of the beautiful structure. Ishmael Hope, who gave additional ideas. And Ernestine Hayes, Bob Sam, and Fran Houston, who gave important feedback. We are grateful to all those offering guidance as we grow as an organization. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. After a two-year hiatus, the Tongass chapter of Trout Unlimited is bringing back their acclaimed fly fishing film tour. Here to tell us more, John Heifetz, president of our local chapter. Hi, John.
Hi, Shelley. How are you?
Good. Thanks. And you?
Good.
And Monica Southworth, who is a board member. Hi, Monica.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being here. John, let's start with you. Can you tell me a little bit about Trout Unlimited and what they do?
So Trout Unlimited is a national organization divided into a bunch of chapters, and Tongass chapter is the one centered in Southeast Alaska. We have about 120 members, and basically nationally, Trout Unlimited is involved with protecting, reconnecting, restoring, and sustaining cold water fishery resources, and mostly involved with conservation of wild trout and salmon populations and their habitat.
So as the president of the local chapter, what are some specific activities or focal points or things that you do locally?
So it's been kind of a slow couple of years because a lot of the activities we do are in-person activities with big groups. But this year we took on a partnership with Trail Mix, where we are putting in basically restoring an old trail in the Montana Creek drainage to make it safer and access for fishermen. We ran a fly casting night at Twin Lakes, where we have a bunch of folks turn out, and we hadn't done it in a while, and we had a lot of fun with that. And then we're involved in some local conservation projects, Montana Creek Master Plan, where there's going to be some more development of trails back there, and we just want to make sure that it's done the right way to protect salmon and trout habitat. And then Monica is going to tell us about some of the other fun events that we've got going on.
Yeah, so I think the most urgent upcoming event that we have is the fly fishing film tour, which you had mentioned, this Friday at the Elizabeth Paradovich Hall at 6:30 p.m. And the tickets are $10 for non-members, $5 for students. And if you are a member, you get in for free. And if you want to sign up to be a member at the door, that's also free upon entry. And we just kind of want to get back together and hang out and watch some films and see each other and hang out.
What's important about recruiting members, or what role do members play in your organization?
I think we're a pretty laid-back group, which is nice, but members, I think a big part is just showing up and participating in some of the events that we have, like the film festival, voting on a budget, showing up to the Trail Mix event. And in the throughout the wintertime, we also have Bar Flies, which is another event that's, again, free, where we get together at local bars and we tie flies for fly fishing all summer long, because what else are you going to do during the winter when you can't fish?
John, you're the president of this local chapter. What are some of the threats to the cold water habitats for fish that you see encroaching in locally or have seen over the years?
Well, locally, like in the Montana Creek drainage especially, there has been increased use of all-terrain vehicles in that watershed, and some of them are not necessarily following the rules, and so we're concerned about them getting into the smaller streams in the watershed that is important rearing habitat where the juvenile fish live. So we've been working with Fish and Game, Forest Service, and others, and with the ATV users to, you know, kind of educate them that, hey, this stream that you might be riding your vehicle in is an important habitat. Even though it's a little trickle, there's juvenile coho salmon in there and cutthroat trout and things like that. So some of it's education and just making sure that, you know, our voice is heard, because Juneau is a fishing community, and we have Montana Creek. It's a basically a blue ribbon stream right in our backyard that's easy access. And, yeah, just want to make sure it's there for everybody.
Monica, as a board member, what motivated you to get involved with Trout Unlimited, and what's important to you about this work?
When I first moved to Juneau, I guess 11 years ago now, I enjoy fishing. We grew up fishing. And I just wanted, it's a way to be a part of the community, whether it's just hanging out and getting fishing reports or talking about where you've been going fishing, I guess. But it's just another way to connect around your hobbies, I guess, is a fair way to say it. And it's something that I'm interested in and wanted to be able to have that conversation with other folks.
And, you know, we've touched on this a little about why your organization is so important. What are some of the other challenges that you face that you have to kind of push back against?
Well, Alaska-wide, and especially in Southeast Alaska, there's been some issues with logging. They, you know, in the 70s, where a lot of the old growth was cut down, they actually logged right down to the stream bank. So right now there's a big effort towards restoration of some of the streams that were affected, especially on Prince of Wales Island and things like that. And actually, Trout Unlimited just hired a new person. We're volunteers, Monica and I, but there is paid staff. They just hired a new restoration biologist. He started here a couple of weeks ago, and he's going to, a lot of his work is going to focus on kind of restoring some of those streams.
And I think, just to add, one of the other issues that we've talked about over the last couple of years is the trans boundary mining issues. So with Canada, mining at the headwaters of major rivers for Southeast Alaska is a huge concern that we've been working with our congressional delegation to make sure that we have a voice at the table as Southeast Alaskans.
Do you feel you have enough resources to make an impact?
Yeah, I think so. In the Tongass Forest, actually, they're transitioning now really from away from logging into making it more recreational. And I think on the federal side, I think things have really moved in the right direction, you know.
Yeah. And there was recently a huge, and I don't know all the details, but a huge investment in Southeast communities to support alternative, I guess, commerce is the best way to phrase it, from the current administration, and support local businesses that usually traditionally would have relied on timber.
I imagine that events such as this upcoming film screening can be a big help in raising awareness and possibly raising funds as well for the local chapter of Trout Unlimited. So I know you're excited to talk about this event. Who would like to start talking about the film tour?
I could talk a little bit about it. So there's going to be 10 short films. There's a group in Colorado that solicits for films every year, and then they screen a bunch. And one of the films that caught my eye, and I know another one caught Monica's eye, it's called Three Sheets, and it was a peak of COVID, and there were three anglers, and they set sail on a catamaran for Belize, and they weren't allowed on the land of Belize. So they had a drone out there, and they were filming themselves in it. They were catching permit, barracuda, and bonefish, which we definitely don't have here in Southeast Alaska. And I think Monica had another favorite one.
I'm super excited for all of them, but one of the movies that seemed really interesting was there was an angler who lives in Montana, and he goes home to Maryland to fish the 17-year cicada hatch cycle. Oh. And so it's obviously not something you can do every year. And so it's called Cicada 17, and it seems I saw the trailer, and it almost seems like a love story, or like he's featuring the cicadas a lot, obviously.
Okay.
In an odd love story to the cicadas, almost.
We've only seen the trailers, right?
Yeah.
You haven't seen all the films yet. I imagine there must be a connection between the cicadas and fishing.
Yes.
Yeah, they hatch, they fall in the water, and then the big trout try to eat them.
Then you
try to imitate that with a fly.
I don't know if you've ever experienced a 17-year cicada emergence. I did once. It was unreal.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, I know you guys have a lot of love for these films. What are some things that you look forward to seeing or learning when you put on this film festival?
What I like, one of the favorite things for me is just seeing all the folks come together and turn out. I mean, it's just you'll get little kids show up, and then adults, students, and we've really missed it. It's kind of our big event for our chapter. It's a little bit of a fundraiser, but a lot of it's just getting together. We usually hold it in the spring, people coming out of winter, but this year has been delayed, and we're showing the 2022 film now, and we'll probably show the 23 film in the spring if this goes smooth. Yeah.
How about you? What do you like about it?
Same. I think it's just nice to have folks get together and chat and hang out. And I think it's worth mentioning that we have quite a few door prizes, which are very exciting. I think our big ticket item this year is Bear Creek Outfitters, local fly fishing outfit, has donated two trips.
No, I think it's a trip for two people.
A trip for two people. Yeah. So two individuals can go on a trip. And I think that if you were going to buy that, retail value is probably $600 or $700.
Yeah, probably more with fuel prices now. Yeah.
Yeah. So. And that's a door prize.
Yeah.
So if you come and have the lucky ticket, then you can have quite a great trip next summer.
Well, that sounds great. The Fly Fishing Film Tour, it's happening this Friday, October 7th, 6:30 to 9 p.m. at Elizabeth Petrovich Hall. And where can we find out more about the event or Trout Unlimited or buy tickets?
You can go to our Facebook page, Tongass Trout Unlimited. You can buy tickets at Alaska Fly Fishing Goods. And we have a link on our Facebook page, and there'll be tickets at the door.
Excellent. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or share before we say goodbye today?
Everyone's welcome to come.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun, and hope we see you all out there.
Great. I hope it inspires some local filmmakers to make their own fly fishing or fishing films, too. Thank you both so much for being here today. John Heifetz, Monica Southworth, Trout Unlimited.
Thank you.
I'm Shelley Delaney, and you're listening to Juno Afternoon. We all grieve, but sometimes are ill-equipped to know how best to support children and teens in their grief. Here with me are Shauna O'Sullivan, president of the Foundation for End-of-Life Care. Hi, Shauna.
Hi.
And Hal Geiger, who is a board member. Hello, Hal.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks so much, both of you, for being here today. Shauna, can you please tell me about the Foundation for End-of-Life Care?
Yeah, the foundation was established really to support hospice and home care in Juneau, and ensure that residents and communities have those hospice services available. But we also focus on community education about end-of-life care.
And what inspired you to not only be a part of the board of directors, but to serve as president?
Actually, I was inspired because my husband was in hospice at his end of life. And I had Dr. Bob Urata was his medical practitioner, and he really opened up a great opportunity for my family to choose how we addressed our situation with my husband's end of life, and really bring in the whole family in a way that was really compassionate and family focused. So Actually, Bruce Weirock invited me to join the board, and I knew about the foundation because they produced a book that is was created to help people plan for end-of-life events and understand what to expect.
And Hal, how about yourself? You're on the board of directors.
Yeah.
What's important to you about doing this type of work?
Well, what's important, I guess in my family, I've gone through deaths, and I've seen the absolute worst way to do it, and I've seen the absolute best facilitated by hospice. And so I guess I would like to, in some small way, try to help people do it the right way. My father just absolutely denied everything about what was happening to him and just went out of this world kicking and screaming. And that wasn't good for anybody. My mother accepted her fate. She had a terminal illness, and she had excellent, excellent hospice care in Eugene, Oregon. But I had already been involved with the foundation for quite a while before that. But if I needed any more motivation, just witnessing what happened in my own family was the motivation.
From both of your points of view, what is the need for this type of work in the community?
We're both looking at each other. you know, when I was in my late 20s and 30s, our friends started having babies, and that was part of life, just the literacy of how that whole process worked and you know, what you needed to do once you got the baby home and taking care of babies. And, of course, that's very wonderful and a very pleasant thing. But the other side of that coin is for everybody that comes into the earth, into this earth, somebody's going to leave, and you can do it well or you can do it poorly. And I'm kind of rambling here now, but I don't know, Shauna.
What would you add to that, Shauna?
I would just like to add that, you know, in rural places like Alaska, and especially in Southeast, and I say that because I've grown up here, healthcare is difficult enough to administer in these areas, and hospice is particularly hard to access and to operate when you have limited resources. So, and I just feel like we serve the community better when we can really look at end of life holistically and not just medically. So I think it's invaluable for families. Like I said, it changed the way that we really look at life and death.
It's not easy stuff to talk about. One might even pose the bigger question is, why is it important? Why is how we leave this world important? Why does it matter once, you know, your life is over?
Well, I think for my family, it came earlier than expected. Mm-hmm. And when you don't plan or think about it, it can be really hard for a family. It's traumatic enough.
Yeah.
And it's easy for me to talk about because I'm so passionate about wanting to see people have the ability and be empowered to make the decisions for people they love without second-guessing themselves and without all of the extraneous fear and doubt that happens. It's a very sacred time of life, and it can be a beautiful time of life. It can be really painful, but also really meaningful. And I know having an opportunity to do it in the way that you know honors your loved ones is really important, and letting your family know what you want at that time is kind of working backwards. When you know how you want to live the last days, oftentimes it makes you think about how you want to live the days you have.
But Shirley, I really know what you mean. I had a friend once who said to me, isn't that kind of morbid what you're talking about? And I thought, what a puzzling question, because of course it's morbid in the sense that it's leading toward more, you know, mortality. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's to take your question, why care about what's happening at the end of life? You might say, why care about health at any point in life? Why care about the health of children? Or why care about health at the middle of life or in middle age? Or why care about health when you're elderly? The next part of that series of questions is, why care about your health, your spiritual health, your physical health, very near the end of life? It's just, to me, it's a question that just answers itself when you think about it.
Good stuff, you guys. This is going deep on Juno Afternoon today. Thank you both very much for sharing some of that personal information. And it's a good segue into speaking about what's happening this Friday. The Foundation for End-of-Life Care is bringing the community a presentation called We All Grieve, and you'll be joined by a few collaborators. Would you please tell me more about this event?
Yeah, this was actually inspired to just help provide more opportunities for people to acknowledge and understand and help young people through grief. Again, what I've witnessed and what my family witnessed was, and oftentimes families have a hard time because they're dealing with loss and they're dealing with all the logistics of a family member dying, and very often the kids are not included. It's really hard to know how to include children in that process, and it's hard to acknowledge grief in children. So we have someone near to Juno in Sitka who is an expert in this. Erin Mathis is a professional licensed counselor, and she has a series of credentials that are backed behind, specifically focused on helping people through grief as a grief counselor. She's been in Sitka for 17 years in counseling and behavioral health, and in the last 9, she's focused on grief counseling. So she's coming in to be a part of this program. And then Melissa McCormick is a founder of Find Your Fire, which is a group that was established to help empower young people to gain confidence and recognize symptoms of depression and, mm-hmm. and grief. And so she's going to come in, and this is going to be more of a workshop. We're going to come in and have a little welcoming and introduce everyone and then break into sessions. So you can choose the session with Erin and focus on learning about activities and language and just steps that you can go through to support very young children through their grief process and also identify the grief process. So educators, family members, everyone's welcome to join. And then by the same token, if you want to know more about the grief process with teens and young adults, you can move into the session with Melissa McCormick.
And this is the second time that we've had an event specifically focused on grief in children and adolescents. And the first one, we brought a fairly famous psychologist from the state of New York, and it was very academic, and I guess I could use the word dry. I could probably even use a word that was even more extreme than that, but it was very academic. And I think that I've known Erin Mathis for a long time. She's just a lovely person, and she's been very involved statewide in grief issues. And I think this is going to be much more a much more warm sort of presentation. And she's a very warm, generous person.
Yeah, it's going to be interactive. It'll be a little conversation, some activities that people can take part in or not. It's going to be very low tech. So we're going to give people a chance to just feel comfortable and informal setting.
Is it targeted to youth or is it targeted more to caregivers?
That is a good question. It's more targeted to caregivers, adults, educators, community members. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we're going to turn away children, and certainly young adults and teens are welcome.
It seems like when we were talking about the planning of this, we were thinking about adults who don't know what to do right. with children when there's grief.
What are some of the things that come up with children, teens, young adults that might be different than how grief would be handled in adulthood?
A lot of times just not acknowledging it, I think, is the most common thing, and that's one thing you'll hear from many people of all ages when they talk about losing someone significant in their life. Often they are left out of the conversation or not able to say goodbyes. They get sent away to someone to take care of them, mm-hmm. and they come mm-hmm. back and their loved one is gone. And so sometimes kids don't know how to interact with each other. So a lot of times I think it's just kind of brushed away or maybe oversimplified. And
Yeah, I don't know much about this, and I certainly
that's
don't.
That's what we're going to learn.
I certainly haven't had to just have many conversations with children and be around that. But I have had many conversations with adults who are left with anxiety from their childhood when death wasn't handled right, it wasn't talked about right, it wasn't explained right.
Yeah, so this is one that we actually were looking for answers to as well.
Yeah. The Foundation for End-of-Life Care will also be announcing Dr. Bob Urata, you mentioned, Hospice Education Fund, recognizing him as Person of the Year. So can you tell me more about Dr. Urata and his work?
Oh, I would love to. I met him 30-some years ago when he came in on very short notice when my wife was pregnant and the pregnancy wasn't quite going right. And, lots of things went wrong. And he was this aggressive guy with black hair, and he was just such a likable person. And
energetic. I don't know about aggressive. He's very gentle.
Well, I don't mean that way in the same way that everybody would use it. But he was in there. He was pushing buttons, and he was trying to figure out what to do. He was not just trying to move into the background. He was trying to make things work, and he did. And so I've known him since then. I got involved in the Foundation for End-of-Life Care when he invited me to join. I ran into him at a funeral of one of his patients, an acquaintance of mine. But he's been the volunteer medical director for hospice for a long, long time. And I stress volunteer. That was his little quiet contribution to the community. He's such a generous person. He's done so much for this community. People that are his patients will know what I mean, but a lot of people don't know him and don't know what a generous person he's been, how much good he's done for families of people who are suffering a terminal illness. You know, we're one of the members are suffering a terminal illness. And he was a founding member of our foundation, and he was very, very generous with his time for decades in this town.
And very passionate about protecting the access to hospice care here in Juneau. So it was really fitting when we were looking for this opportunity to open a fund through the Bartlett Regional Hospital Foundation. And so we established the fund with a $20,000 donation and also have an active $20,000 matching challenge for anyone who wants to contribute. And we've had some providers contribute, so that is now up to $33,000. And so this fund is actually going to support hospice education. It's the Dr. Bob Urata Hospice Education Fund. And it is the purpose is to support any medical practitioner, so anyone in Juneau who wants to pursue hospice education or training, and they can apply through the Bartlett Foundation.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm happy to hear that Dr. Urata will be honored in such a fitting fashion.
Yeah.
We All Grieve is this Friday, October 7th at 6 p.m., Thunder Mountain High School. It's free and open to all. Where can we find out more information about this event or about the End of Life Foundation?
Well, hopefully we have flyers up around, but we do have a website. And, of course, I could recite it here. We'll have QR readers on brochures at our event, so we'll have some materials to share out, but it's foundationforendoflifecareak.org is our website.
Very easy to find in a search.
Yeah. If you Google search End of Life Juno, you'll find us.
Anything else either of you two would like to share before we say goodbye?
Well, I can't think of anything. I'm sure there's something, but
I'm sure you'll think of it as soon as you walk out the door.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's really neat to be able to get back into person and have events like this and to get to honor Dr. Urata. So I appreciate the time.
Of course. I appreciate you both being here today. Hal Geiger, Shauna O'Sullivan, End of Life Foundation for End of Life Care. Thanks very much. And I'm wishing you well in your event on Friday.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for being here. I'm Shelley Delaney, and joining me now is Glow Ramirez, an artist based here in Juneau who has a show opening this Friday. Welcome, bienvenido.
Hi, gracias.
Hi, Glow. It's good to see you. Would you please introduce yourself?
Yeah. So my name is Glow Ramirez. I have been a guest in Clinkatani for 6 years, but I was born and raised in Puerto Rico.
And how did you come to be a professional artist?
I think I still struggle with the professional artist part. But it's just something that actually I enjoy and love. And the more you do, the more you start believing that you are part of the art community.
I love that. just go for it. How would you describe your work for people who have never seen it before?
So in Juno, I'm mostly known for these little creatures that I call monsters, and they're pretty fun and cuddly. even if their background, it's that it comes from my fears. But I do have a whole gamma of different arts that I do, from abstracts to landscapes. It's just, I do jewelry too somehow. But I think the monsters or those illustrations are what actually makes me happy. So I'm very happy to just be known by those.
I think a lot of people know you by those too. You mentioned your fears. How does a fear, a personal fear, translate to a character, a monster?
So I feel like when I got here, one of the things that actually was very impactful is that it was summer and we had light all the time. So I feel like Puerto Rico have regular hours until 6 or 7 p.m. and then, starts the mm-hmm. sun and starts going down. So just that first impact of not being able to sleep and not knowing people, there is a lot of wilderness and I'm a city girl. So I started making this little fluffy creatures. So basically the first one was the night, and it had stars and everything on it. And they have this wooden mask. So it's kind of a way of portraying your fears into something cute. That doesn't mean that you're overcome everything. It's just the fact that once you see it in this cute form, it's manageable and you just can keep going. You hang out with your fears and your situations and stuff and you keep going every day. They're still there, but once you make them your body, it's more.
It's the epitome of art therapy. Yeah. I love that. Very cool. What is your process like? How do you like to work? Do you like to work during a certain time of day, or do you have some sort of ritual before you begin to sketch?
I think it's everyday thing. I do work in an office. I do work on a nonprofit, and I, even with how hectic it is, just having any moment to doodle or sketch around all those notes that you have to make through your meetings.
Mm-hmm. I do that too.
It's part of it. Plus, it's any experience. If I go on a boat, things are different for me. On these 6 years, I've had so many new experiences. So the fact that at a moment I was I don't want to go hike to the glacier, and then you do it. And then mm-hmm. it's this whole process on how to put that into a drawing or that type of thing. But I don't have a set up time. Anytime that I get a chance, I do pick up a pen or pencil and I start doodling. Yeah.
What are some of the mediums you like to work in, and what is your final product like?
Right now, I'm very interested in doing digital art. So I have my tablet and I get a chance to sketch in there and have different products and textures and stuff. My favorite medium is watercolors. And I can do other, but that's my favorite one. I like how moody it is. How can you say it's kind of life? It's very dry. You have to nurture it to get the color out of the of that block of pigment, and then how you use it, how it flows in your paper depending on the amount of water, how sometimes it's not what you're actually thinking that you want as a as an actual result, but it end up working somehow.
I like that. Who would you say some of your influences are? Other artists or illustrators?
So I, when I started, as studying art, Bob Thompson was this person that I used to look up all the time, and Basquiat. And I think those were like the first one. As illustrations comes, Babs, she used to draw Batgirl for a while. Like, she was the one who revived it.
Yes.
So that was like the main person as a woman illustrator. In town, I've had the pleasure of meeting like so many people. Pat Reyes, who owns Alaska Robotics, and all the people that he brings for Minicon, that you sometimes get a chance to talk to them. Those are wonderful influences. Like, you follow them, they are very welcoming, they let you, you know, pick their brain and stuff. So, yeah.
How do you maintain a connection to Puerto Rico from here in Tlingitani?
Aside from calling every day.
Calling every day. Wow.
Yeah, I do maintain that contact. I try my best to, aside from keeping the friends and family that I have there, donating and working with different people. Right now, I am learning how to make my own pigments out of nature, because there is a woman in Puerto Rico that's her main thing. So I meet with her through Zoom, and we sometimes plan, and hopefully this winter, to go into Puerto Rico and work more on that. I feel technology has been just pretty great so far.
It really helps to close the distance.
Yes.
And it's getting better and better all the time. Do you feel that the island is recovering okay after being hit so hard by yet another hurricane? And that was just last week. I mean, what do people down there need, and what's their morale like?
I feel like people are tired of being resilient and just being looked at. They need to overcome a lot of things to just live, like basic needs, even to areas that were not directly hit by the hurricane, have been getting electricity this week or this weekend. So the situation in there is like very political. Like, there is no question about it. Like, it's an island that it's the oldest colony, still owned by the states. It is like in a very strategic place, but that ownership, it doesn't let it, be its own. Like, we have so many things imposed, plus they pay the higher taxes as American citizens. And aside from that, they're not getting the help that they actually need to recover. And we understand there are many other situations, you know, like politics, and the government might not be using the resources as fast as they need to. But also there are other situations involved in there. Yeah.
It's a difficult situation. And, you know, Puerto Rico, like Juneau, like Tlingitani, like Alaska, has history rooted in colonialism, and mm-hmm. I'm sure you have noticed some similarities there in a lot of different ways. I understand one of your new pieces has the theme of resistance. Is that a way that you kind of express your feelings around that?
Yeah. So one of my pieces, it's Puerto Ricans have adopted like their flag just painted all in black as a way of, you know, every fin has been sucked out of it, even the color.
Wow.
And so that resistance, that moment of resistance, like they painted the flag in black. So one of my little monsters, it's basically come from that situation. So it has like the flag in black on its face. In this piece, it will have like a QR code that people can scan, and that way they can just watch like this music video / documentary that Bianca Gralau made about the situation of the electricity in Puerto Rico.
Wow. Well, Glow, I can't wait to see that, and I can't wait to see the rest of your work that's going to be on display this first Friday at Alaska Robotics Gallery, which seems like a great fit. You know, I think a lot of your monsters kind of look like little characters in a story or a comic book already. So anything you'd like to share, any details about the exhibit you'd like people to know before they come?
I think it is pretty colorful. It's pretty cute. I want to say that the tagline on my art, it's I make cute but cool stuff, yes. And they fit right there. Just saying that you just need like something that will make you smile or will make you like feel something, and that's the goal with all the little monsters. And I hope that people enjoy it. Honestly, it has been a long time to do a solo show, so I am looking forward to it.
Oh, congratulations on the reemergence and your first solo exhibit in a couple of years. And it's also been great to talk with you.
Yes.
I think it's our first interview in a couple of years
as
well.
Long time.
So hopefully not the last. Glow Ramirez exhibit opening this first Friday, 4:30 at Alaska Robotics Gallery down on Front Street. Thank you so much, mil gracias, for being here today. I really appreciate it. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. It is the first week of the month, so you know what that means. Here with me is Kathleen Harper from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. Hi, Kathleen.
Hey, Shelley. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
We're getting settled in here still.
There we go.
I was going to say the other headphones might work better.
Oh, there we go.
Well, October 1st, Friday is upon us. Are you one of those folks who gets like really excited for spooky season?
You know, I love spooky season, but not as much as my coworker Laura, Maiko. So
the offices all decked out.
We are gonna have we're gonna be painting pumpkins as a staff and using them to decorate our lobby shop. So that'll be fun.
Oh, that does sound like very fun, very seasonally appropriate, fun,
yes.
Fantastic. Can't wait to see those. What's on tap for this month's first Friday?
So we've got quite a few fun things going on. First up, at of course. The Juno Arts and Humanities Council Gallery. We've got Chloe Cavanaugh, a solo exhibition. Chloe Cavanaugh is a graphic designer, a local LGBTQ+ Indigenous artist. So that's going to be really cool. She believes Indigenous voices belong in all spaces and seeks to use her traditional Thlinget values to guide her, which is really cool. If people want to get a little sneak peek of some of her work, you can check out her website, blackandwhiteravencompany.com. And she's got some pretty cool stuff on there. So we're excited to see what all she's going to have for us during the show. And she's donating all the proceeds from her show to the Aware Shelter. So if you're interested in seeing some cool art, maybe getting something cool and supporting a good cause, come on down.
Oh, that's very generous.
Yes. Yeah. So we're really excited to have her in the gallery this month. It's your last chance. I know we've been talking about Mug Up for several months now.
Yeah.
But this is it, folks.
This is really it.
This is the last chance. The show closes after this Saturday. So if you haven't seen it and you're like, oh, it's so much money to go to the museum, remember, First Friday is free. So that is always a good incentive to come on down to the State Museum on those First Fridays. They're also going to have a free 4 to 6 PM viewing on Saturday, October 6th, too. So, or October 8th, excuse me. Tomorrow's the 6th. Anyway.
That's right. So Saturday the 8th, there's another free viewing, you said, from 4 to 6.
Yes.
Cool.
As well as several interesting lectures that they're hosting as well. If you want to find out more information about those, you can go to the Jack's little First Friday kind of flyer section on our website, or check out the museum's website as well. So, but some pretty cool stuff there. They've got like a Filipino American History Month kind of collaboration with Oscar Penarada coming in to do a lecture about cannery work on Friday. And then their, Katie Ringsmith giving a couple of different lectures on Saturday. So if you're interested in even deeper dives into history, that might be for you.
This mug up exhibit is a pretty big deal, and it's one of a kind. This is really, there won't really be another chance to see it. So I do encourage everyone to go.
Other fun things we got going on. Kindred Post is doing kind of a spinning earth into art with Sharon Price exhibit. So Sharon's actually going to be showing the process from wedging to throwing at Kindred Post. So if you want to see somebody actually like throw some pots.
Oh, nice.
It would be fun to go and stop by that. That is a little earlier than some of the other ones. That's 3:30 to 6. There's Barnaby Brewing has Rebecca Hirsch. I might be mispronouncing her last name, and if so, I apologize. But she's doing some kind of cool, cozy artwork using embroidery and needle punching and mixed media. So kind of gearing up for that fall feeling where we all want to put on our sweaters and, like, you know, she's kind of digging into that with her kind of fun crafts. Annie Kale's featured artist is Kelsey Fagan, who does watercolor and ink works. So she does those little pieces that have the words of affirmation in her pieces and stuff.
Familiar.
So, they're a lot of fun.
It's beautiful.
Always
stuff.
Good to check that out as well. And
got time for maybe one or two more.
Okay. Juno Artist Gallery is doing their Juno Appreciation Sale. So this is a good time to stop by the Juno Artist Gallery, check out all the fun artists that they have there. There's 16 different artists who each have a section in the gallery. So it's a good chance to see what some of the locals are doing as well.
That's awesome.
In the downtown core. And then I guess the final thing, which you probably have already heard, but Perseverance Theater is actually opening their first show on First Friday. Henry Koshkatas is Where the Summit Meets the Stars. And I did just go and see an invited dress last night, and I highly recommend it. It is
getting
so
a lot
good.
Of buzz, getting a lot of buzz around here. So, yeah, that sounds great. I think they'll be on to talk about that, too. Kathleen Harper from Juno Arts and Humanities Council, thanks so much for that roundup.
No worries. Thank you, Shelley.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for tuning in today. Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, Culture Rich Conversations is back for season 3. The first episode will feature a roundtable of very special guests discussing today's hot topics in Black culture with Christina Michelle as host and moderator. It's a brand new season with new topics, new guests, and the great interviews you've come to expect. You don't want to miss it. Juno Afternoon broadcasts live Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. on KTOO. The show repeats at 7 p.m. right here on 104.3 and 91.7. Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Clinkett and Haida Social Enterprises. To find out more about anything we discussed today or to be on the show yourself, check out ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.